Mr. Day, Reel 5. Oh, you were telling me about a rugby match against 8th Field Artillery.
Yes. I thought it was a Saturday night soldiers in territory, and we had not much fun with that. We didn't have much appreciation because they were regulars anyway. You took them up with the football. Or rugby football, you put the ball on your hand, and then you run and you hand off. In this particular rugby football match, there was no handing off. As soon as you got the ball, in this particular match, you hit anyone, friend or foe, as hard as you could with your fist. And before very long, everybody was bleeding. I remember towards half time, Charles de Gaulle, who was an English farmer, and he picked their scrum off and threw him over the line, on which the referee sent him off. And so we downed the referee. And would not play against him until Charles de Gaulle was established, which he was. A new referee. And I recall that sometime towards the end of the match, I was the smallest man in the field in three quarters, and somebody passed the ball on the line and I got the ball. I was fairly fast, but at that particular time I was really sliding. I remember stepping round, or going round the fullback and diving, and I think the rest of the two sides landed upon me and I scored from inside. I remember getting back to the RAP and filling and said, what the bloody hell's happened to you, Mom dear? You look like a bloody road accident, you know, and blood covered by the swimming, seriously. That was the football match against the 8th Field, and then we were supposed to take them on at boxing.
Hang on a minute. It was so rough then because of the antipathy between the regulars and the territorials. Who started it? I mean, normally in a rugby match, if there's trouble, one side...
Oh, no, I think there's a few can see.
By both sides?
Oh, yes. I don't think there's any real deep-down animosity. It was a bit superficial because, you know, we thought we were good lads. We thought we were good for £25 on, and I suppose they thought we were much better because they were regulars then. But not really deep down.
There wasn't that, so the animosity was shallow.
Shallow.
Was there any real bad feeling?
No.
Now, you said that a boxing match was organised.
When we played them at the 8th Field at football, we put them on at boxing. We had an eliminator in the regiment, the regimental eliminator, and I boxed Fred Lamb. Fred Lamb, he was much taller than me, and he's got a lovely straight left, which he kept peppering my nose with. And I tried to get underneath it, but never succeeded until I looked like a bloodbath. And I was told by the sergeant, PT instructor, to go and have a shower and forget about it, which I did. But old Fred went down with sunflower fever, so I had to do my best against this other bloke from the 8th Field. It was pretty sort of level up to the last round, three rounds, and he hit me on the nose, which upset me no end, and I won a split points this evening. Both of them have been on the campus several times, but that was my one of many appearances as a boxer for the South Potts as ours.
Who won the overall?
I think we did. Albert Swinton did the heavyweight. I don't know whether you've met him or interviewed him. He did the heavyweight, Albert Swinton. He was a policeman, I believe. Albert Swinton. But he's still around.
What other sports?
At Merz, right?
Yes, at Merz.
We did play football. We played rugby football. I don't remember any... I mean, we did swim every day. I can't remember anything competitive in swimming.
Did you have... That was in the lagoon or in the bay?
That's right.
Did you have a go on the boat? Some of them had a boat, I understand, a sailing dinghy. Did you have a go on that?
No. I did once, and only once. I think there was a chaplain, was it the Middlesex Yeomanry? He was a sailor, and were you supposed to go about or something? And I remember the boom hitting me under the nose and knocking me into the water, so I refused to go into down here again. That's what I'm sure. My son, he's a good sailor.
What about there are stories that they had sort of concert party, a South Notch Hussars concert party that would perform while they were at Mercer in the evening?
Yes.
What do you remember of that?
Yes, it was Sam Moore. He was the impersonator.
What was he like?
Little Sam, he lived in Derbyshire. He used to do Max Miller. I don't know who was that. He was an impersonator. Max Miller, he took off Hawaii and several comedians at that time. Larry Lambert used to do ukulele solos. And Mercer 2, Patrick Selwyn Fraser Bland, he was in charge of his own little canteen. A little mired up, little sort of olive grove. And we used to fall gather in the evenings, a group of us, and have sing songs and all get sniped a bit and go back to the island at night. And
what do you mean by sniped a bit?
Drunk.
Drunk. Yeah. Could you get alcohol?
You could get beer, Pilsner, and lucky supplies and whatever. Yeah, remember we used to drink beer, we used to drink spirits.
What type of a character was Pat Lamb?
Red face, ginger hair, thick set. Never met a braver man in my life. From desert sores, from being fair, you know, sort of prone, light skin, he came from a family. Stockbrokers in Nottingham, very good Nottingham family. His brothers and he played cricket. His brothers played cricket for not seconds, I believe. I met his mother after the war, she gave me a friend for him.
Now, so that was how you'd amuse. Any other ways you'd amuse yourself?
I can't bring to mind any other.
Now, what one thing I'd forgotten. And we hadn't mentioned was that one of the things that did come along were that some of the desert diseases started while they were at Mercer. You mentioned two, sandfly fever. What exactly was that?
Well, there was a fly in the desert, the sandfly, which and it sort of was like, I would think, well, it gave you a temperature of about 104. You had to be treated by mainly it's acid, things like that. It probably took about 24, 48 hours. It was quite an acute thing. It didn't last very long.
So it was a short, sharp.
Not like malaria, only a sort of a far lesser thing. It wasn't a lingering thing. It wasn't a thing that was going to last over the year, just an acute thing.
It didn't recur either.
No, as a rule, no, it didn't. Something I don't remember anybody suffering from it twice. I had it very badly at Mercer 2.
How did you feel when you got it?
Terrible. You had a high fever. And you produced sweating and you felt feverish and weak and nothing. Lucky you got a terrific dose of flu.
And just for 48 hours?
Yeah, it didn't last very long.
Now that's one of the things. The other thing that started were desert sores, I believe. Yeah. You mentioned Pat Bland, yeah. Hasn't it?
Well, this, of course, was due to the lack of vitamins, chiefly vitamins like fruit and fresh vegetables.
You didn't have any of them?
Very little, very little.
And what were they like?
You lived on tin food and bully beans.
How would a desert sore start? Did you have them yourself?
It would start if a man he struck himself on a. On a stone, on a piece that just fell over. You got a small abrasion. A small abrasion that would develop. It would get infected, develop, and they would have a desert sore about the size of, in some cases, almost the size of a small orange, tangerine.
Now, were they sort of an open, sort of pussy area of wound, or were they like a carbuncle? I've never been.
No, an open area. They're suturating, of course. And the treatment was various. Some men yielded to one treatment, and another man yielded to another.
What were some methods you'd try?
Well, we did M&B powder, sulfur minimized powder, hot fermentations, zinc ointment. There was a lot of.
What would you try if someone came in, like Pat came in, Pat Bland, what would you try first?
Acrophlaxin ointment.
And then if that didn't work?
You'd try something else.
But you wouldn't try more than one at once, probably?
No.
And were the methods, I mean, with these range of treatments, would you be able to get rid of a desert sore, or?
In most cases, yes. In some cases, they had to be evacuated. It became secondary infected, and the lymph glands were affected, and the man raised the upper temperature, a prolonged temperature, had to be evacuated. But not many were. But some of them had pretty bad days.
What are the desert? How about dysentery? Did that make...
Was it what we call yippee tummy? It was a bacillary dysentery.
Is that yippee or jippy?
Jippy. That was a form of bacillary dysentery, not the amoebic type, which was a far more serious. Amoebia is an organism which devours the blood corpuscles. If you have a microscope, you can see the UV eating corpuscles.
But you didn't get that?
Not there. No.
Not there. No. So this lesser, so jippy tummy, what, yeah. That the symptoms would just be going to the loo a lot?
Yes, sort of a perpetual diarrhea, really. Yeah.
And how would you, would they come to you with that, what treatment would you give for that?
As a lot of starvation treatment, no food. Plenty of food if they get fruit juice or water. And if they yielded okay, if they didn't, then they have to be evacuated because these were contagious and it was essential that it was localised.
What about the opposite, constipation? I mean, with all that tinned food, was that a problem at all?
No, can't recall it being. There was a lot of ear, well, I say not a lot of it, there was ear trouble, people suffering from the typhus immediately affecting the middle ear. Which had to be treated.
What could cause that?
Sound getting in the ear. And one or two more elderly members, I think, a member of the ear, they had the wax, which had to be treated with olive oil to soften it up and then syringed out the next morning, which came out like the ash of a cigar into the kidney basin. There's an old chap, he went, oh, you see, what I did in the ear, he was all able to go those times, that time of day. And he used to suffer wax, and his name was Moderate. He used to say, how are you? Oh, Moderate. Now, what about you? Oh, come on, man. And of course, when his wax was in, you had to shout your head off, and when it was out, if you raised your voice more than one octave, you know, it might knock your head off.
Yeah. And this ear trouble from the sound, that was just... What did it cause? Would it cause an infection in it, in there?
It might cause an infection in there, yes.
And how would you treat that?
As I just knew, you used to drop a couple of drops of vitamin peroxide and use the next day, and then a sliver of gauze with glycerin and phenol, and take it out next morning and as gently as possible syringing the air out in warm, sterile water, and reinserting another gauze of glycerin and phenol. Again, if it proved a prolonged ailment,
Right, we've looked at aspects of the routine in Mercer, which went on a fair while from about...
It lasted about 9 months.
And eventually, during Wavell's offensive, this is when you were attached to the RAMC, Casualty Clearing Station.
An underground casualty clearing station, which was serving those named Geddes, and we worked there and night. On first the British wounded, which were evacuated down to the base, and then to the Italian wounded, who were suffering from severe wounds to the buttocks. They had been laying in the sand, shell fire had cut apart, cut the buttocks off, and they were suffering from gas gangrene.
Could you just explain gas gangrene?
It looked like a cabbage to look at it. The wound was bloated. The buttock, can you imagine a buttock being bloated looking like a cabbage? A lot of the dead tissue had to be cut away, of course, by the doctor.
Would the flesh actually go green?
That's right.
And what would cause that? What had caused that infection?
Well, it would be caused by the infection setting in, and of course, lack of treatment, probably over several days, just laying out in the desert with these wounds.
What was the difference between gas gangrene?
And gangrene. Different organisms. Gas gangrene, BPSCMS, I believe it was called. And gangrene, that was sort of a superficial gangrene, as opposed to a limb being devoid of blood, which causes gangrene, the limb has to be amputated.
And the treatment for gas gangrene that you were getting in?
Well, we used to address it and cut away the dead tissue, and of course down to base, evacuate.
Now, what state, when the British casualties arrived in at the CCS, what state would they be in? What would be have been done for them?
Well, it was always marked on the warhead with skin pencil, what time they'd been given TAB, or what time they'd been given morphia, and how much they'd been given.
Now, the TAB, that would be the tetanus booster, would it? Or?
No, TAB was ATS, anti-tetanus serum, ATS, which would contain a little glass vial. That was given by in subcutaneously.
That means
under the skin, subcutaneous, intravenously into the vein. This was given subcutaneously, and also morphia was given subcutaneously. And the amount of morphia, I may be correct, and I believe it was half a cc.
And that would be
written in a skin pencil on the forehead, or if there was any injury to the head, then somewhere where it was easily seen by people. The
now, if you'd actually, I mean, if that would be, what would happen if you did inadvertently give another tetanus serum? Well, would that actually cause any damage to someone?
No, I don't think two doses of ATS would, but the morphine would. You'd have to watch that.
That would.
It all depends how long it elapsed between the first and the second injection.
So, what else would they come in? Would they come in on stretchers?
Yes, if they were, unless they were walking wounded, you know, saying that they'd come in.
Would the walking wounded or still have the...
Yeah, if they had been, supposedly got a fractured arm or something like that, or a compound fractured limb or the... and they'd been given...
So no one was ever trusted with a chit of paper or anything?
No, the government and I might have had some... Well, everybody was under the stress and shock. You had to be treated accordingly with shock.
So they'd come in, and what was the first thing that would happen to them?
Well, they'd be seen by the surgeon.
So they'd go straight to the surgeon.
Yeah.
How did they prioritise treatment? I mean, if you get a few people arrived together, who decided who went to the surgeon first, or did the surgeon decide?
The surgeon decided which was the more seriously wounded man and treat accordingly.
And he'd do that at a glance, so to speak.
And then when he got to have a look at the wound. You've got to take the bandage or the shell dressing or the field dressing off and have a look at the wound.
What I mean is, how would he decide which one to see first? Would it be just obvious who was
obvious? Obvious.
And it was in order of wounded. What happened if someone was too badly? I mean, was there a stage beyond which they were so badly wounded you'd go to the next? You'd go to someone who you might save?
Not until you assessed it and diagnosed it accordingly. So how exactly the extent of the wound was. I mean, a wound, or they might be unconscious, maybe comatose. We've got to have a look at the wound to assess it.
So it was always the most serious first, even if it might prove that it was so serious that you'd be almost wasting your time with the resources you have. You'd still check that wound first and then move to the next.
That's right.
Yes. And during that preliminary check that he was doing, well, when he was seeing them taking the shell dress, having a look, would he do that on his own or would he have someone like yourself?
I would take it off.
So you'd
be taking it off.
That would be your job, taking a bandage off and showing it to the surgeon.
Opening the wound to display the wound for him to for his inspection and for his diagnosis.
Was this just the diagnosis stage then, or would he actually start treating someone?
If they require urgent treatment, yes, but it's entirely up to him. I mean, he has all tourniquet as long, it might have to be released to allow the blood to continue on before the artery would not be attended to until he got down to base. So it all depends upon it.
So he takes sort of emergency action or urgent action while he was but if it wasn't urgent, he just passed on to the next down the line.
Down the base. And most of them went down there to the hospitals in Alexandria and Cairo, 15 Scottish.
With a lot of them, would he just not do anything to them? Or would they always get...
It all depends upon the extent of the wound. If it wasn't, it was only sort of it wouldn't be a minor thing, because otherwise they wouldn't be at the CCS. They'd been treated at their particular regimental aid post, and then possibly be dispatched down the line, or sent back to the unit if it was just a sort of a superficial wound, give him a couple of days rest, and back to.
So during this first inspection, they'd all be diagnosed, and then what would happen then?
We'd see the cord again. And then, of course, if they were eventually, the ambulance would take them down to the base hospital.
Were there any beds at all, or was it just stretchers?
There were beds. It was an underground hospital.
When would they be put from the stretchers into the beds?
When they came back from the front line, from the scene of the activity, the scene of the battle, come by ambulance or by truck, whatever, and be taken by a stretcher, or if they could walk, then they'd be taken into bed, you see.
So they go to bed before the surgeon saw them?
In most cases, yes. Yes.
Unless it was too difficult.
That's
to.
Right. Yeah.
So your job was displaying the wound to the.
What are the? The dressing board burned, the wound was treated, anaesthetic given in where it needed.
Could you make that decision yourself?
No, that's the surgeon.
Would you administer it though if he said so?
Under his instructions, yes.
Under his eye, or under his instruction?
Under his instruction.
So he'd say, and what was the usual dosage for morphine? Was the morphine your only pain-killing?
Well, we had chloroform, which was used every very sparingly. I tried to get burned, it gets too near to the nostrils of the mouth. But we sort of ran out of morphine at one stage, and we had to use chloroform.
So morphine was your painkiller?
Right.
Chloroform would be your.
That was the anaesthetic, the general anaesthetic.
That was to put you asleep?
Yes.
Yeah. So how much more? You have to be very careful, as you mentioned, with morphine.
I believe the initial, a small dose of half a cc. It's a long time ago.
Would you ever have to give large amounts of morphine at that stage?
In the case of lethal mortal wounds, when men were beyond the possibility of medical treatment, and this was the only thing to do.
Was that seen, I know this comes into it later, that seen as being, throughout the RAMC, which you weren't in, but was that a general medically accepted thing in the war?
I believe so, yes, in other units as well. Yes.
But it wasn't formally stated, I presume?
Not to my knowledge, no.
But it was an informal, an accepted practice?
Yes.
Did you see any instances of it at that stage? I mean, were there.
At Mosley too, no. No, because these men came along and whatever their wounds were, I mean, I think it's fair to say that had they been to such an extent that they required lethal doses of anaesthetic, they wouldn't have lasted that amount of time. The battle was, as modern warfare was then, and of course it is now more so, the battle was continuously going on from Mosama to Ibrani, Tumas, east, west, and on, Monica, then of course we're up to Derna, Bardian, Brooklyn, so of course these were things in the future. But the desert, the battle kept on moving, and of course these men had to be brought from the scene of the activities in events, ambulances or trucks or whatever, to our CCS in Mosama too.
So there was no chance. If they'd made it that far, it was presumed that they stood at least a chance, so they wouldn't need this sort of dose.
That's right.
That's very clear about what was. What were your other duties? Because you said during the three days, I think, you were attacked. And
I was working for 3 days and 3 nights non-stop. At the end of which, I didn't know whether they were family or not, or what I was doing. I was in a term of almost collapse.
How many men were coming in? I mean, what?
All continuous.
I mean, hundreds of men. I'm trying to get an idea of.
Hundreds as opposed to thousands, yes. But the Italians, of course, far outnumbered the British casualties in the latter stages. We sort of got rid of the British casualties. Down to base before the Italians start to come in droves.
When you did have, this sounds callous, but when you did have a British and Italian casualty together, Was it still on complete medical grounds? So the surgeon wouldn't take the British most serious before the... I'm just clearing this point up rather than...
No, there was no national boundaries, no national bonds. People were treated as human beings with various forms, whatever the forms of wounds they suffered with, whatever the extent of their injuries, irrespective of nationality previously.
What was the morale of the men who'd been wounded, of both sides? I mean, how did they... I mean, it's a shattering thing to happen, to be wounded in that. How did most of them manage to respond?
I thought the British very well. Well, all the British troops very, very well indeed. We were winning. We were on the up and up. The Italians had been very badly equipped. They got no answer to the Matilda tank. They got no weapon that could penetrate. And they were just slaughtered.
But how did it actually affect them when they were wounded? Do you see what I mean?
Yes, they were in a state of extreme distress. And all they wanted to do was to say, in Italian, statente. So be careful, and show you the photographs of their wives and their children and their sweethearts, and explain in detail. And this, of course, I learned Italian from it. Also, I learned from the Italian drugs that were being captured, things like aspirin. Pugalodale, dose powders, bismuth diopia, things bismuth and everything like that. By reading the Italian drugs, one could easily assimilate the things with the Italian drugs. The English drugs, of course, it all comes from Latin anyway. Most of medical terminology derives from Latin terminology. So one learned a great deal of the language.
So the Italians were generally downcast.
Right.
And the British, what their... Yeah.
On the up and up.
The wounded as well, though.
Oh, yes. You know, they're providing they weren't so wounded that they could not, or they weren't conscious and they couldn't talk, articulate, they were quite.
Was there a culture, I mean, now you've heard in the First World War the idea of a blighty wound. Was there much of that, did you find at that stage much of a blighty wound culture in the British troops? Would people be pleased to get a nice flesh wound? I mean, to get away, or had that not developed?
I know two men which are the nameless that I think did, but at that time, no one. Everyone was sort of boosted up by the fact that the Italians far outnumbered us. We were pleased to have stopped them and taken vast hordes of prisoners and advanced on up the desert. And